Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 10th of March. We are trying to locate Joyce Carol Oates, who I hope will be able to join us this hour. She is the author, most recently, of A Widow's Story, which is a memoir about the death of her husband. In 2008, she drove her husband, Raymond Smith, who is from Milwaukee, actually, to the emergency room of the Princeton Medical Center, where he was diagnosed with pneumonia. They thought he would be released in a day or two, but he died from a hospital-acquired infection that went into both his lungs. And she received a phone call after having had a pretty good day with him, went home and got one of those calls in the middle of the night saying that he had died. And this is a very beautifully written, because she is one beautiful writer, book about the stunning reality of being a widow. It includes a whole lot of information about their lives together. They, I don't think, ever called each other by their names. They called each other honey, honey, honey. And many people have been through the experience of losing a loved one, and she writes about this whole process quite movingly. So we're trying to find her, and I'm not sure what we're going to do if we don't find her, so I'll have to think of something. Somebody call and give a suggestion in case this doesn't happen. She is the recipient of the, now just keep talking, the National Book Circle's Ivan Standroff Lifetime Achievement Award. She has won awards for excellence in short fiction, has been nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. She has written some of the most enduring fiction of our time, including the national bestsellers We Were the Mulvaneys, Blonde, which was nominated for the National Book Award, and the New York Times bestseller The Falls. Her husband was a book editor and magazine editor, and she's written many, many other books. I remember interviewing her, it must have been 8 years ago or so. What did she write 8 years ago? Well, let me look at some of the other things that she's written here. She's done a whole lot of nonfiction and The Edge of Impossibility, Tragic Forms in Literature, Contraries, The Profane Art, Essays and Reviews on Boxing, George Bellows, American Artist, Where I've Been and Where I'm Going, Essays, Reviews, and Prose, The Faith of a Writer, Views and Reviews Uncensored, The Journal of Joyce Carol Oates. She kept a journal and has for a number of years. And so that's just a little bit about what she's written. The Wisconsin connections here are very interesting, because she met her husband at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. They were both in graduate school in literature, and she had also, at the age of 19, she had some of her work published. He was about 7 or 8 years older than she, and was doing his dissertation on Jonathan Swift, and they immediately had that light that you can find with someone, and they were engaged a month later and then were married shortly thereafter. So there's a lot of Wisconsin woven into this book as well. And her husband grew up in Milwaukee and went to Marquette High School. And his, I don't know if you could say struggles is the right word, but his how Catholicism stayed with him in his life, and purgatory. For those of us who grew up Catholic, you remember that phrase. I was always worried about purgatory. Purgatory and heaven and hell and Mary and all the images and things that she found out about him after he had died by going through his papers, and she found out some secret parts of his life that she didn't know anything about. And it's very moving, because those of us who have been, and it's many of us now, who have been in the hospital and going through the reports and going through the ups and the downs and thinking things are going to be okay, and then going to another facility. And it's a very moving book. And she's, what's the story, Chrissy? We don't know where she is. Well, what to do? I think the only thing I can do is hope that we will get her sometime during the course of this hour. And it's a difficult topic for me to just jump into. Well, let's talk about our experiences of being widows or losing somebody we loved. I'm not going to do that without Joyce Carol Oates. I just won't do that. So let's open phone lines. We have been jammed for weeks and weeks and weeks. We now have an interesting development in Madison. Collective bargaining bill put separate from the budget repair bill, which did pass, and a lot of people have a lot to say about this issue. So I will wait for Christine to make this one more phone call. She's got all kinds of phone numbers for her, but she's not answering. So we'll wait for her to make a call, and maybe we'll, bingo, have a connection. If not, we will just move to your thoughts about what happened yesterday and your support for the governor or lack thereof. Where do you think things go from here? The national nature of what's happening in Wisconsin, and whether or not you see this as a winning strategy for the Republicans. There are some Democrats who are very engaged in a recall process now. But to say the least, things are incredibly polarized in the state of Wisconsin. I've lived here for 36 years, and I ain't never seen nothing like this. So I'm sure that, oh my gosh, all I had to do is say that and all four phone lines are going. So until we can find Joyce Carol Oates, we're just going to have to take some phone calls and on what's going on in Wisconsin, and that's that. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number. I do want to tell you that you can always... our email, too, in case you want to send me a message and we can read it and somebody else can respond to it, is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Christy will just do three things at once. She will get you on hold, and she'll keep trying to reach Joyce Carol Oates, who I know, man, I've been talking about this for a week. I hope she shows up, because I know many of you really rightfully love her work, and it was going to be an important conversation. What can I say? Let's just go to phone calls. Jerry in Superior. What do you want to talk about, Jerry? Hi.
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 I think we should talk about what's behind this this move by Scott Walker. And my opinion is that it's really just an agenda that's written by the Heritage Foundation and some of the other similar billionaire finance think tanks that are trying to limit the amount of money that they are taxed on and put it on the backs of the rest of the citizens.
Do you think that's it? It seems to me as though it has to be more than that. I haven't figured this out yet. I don't know why people wouldn't sit at the table and hash this out. I don't know what's in it for politicians to have tens of thousands of people demonstrate and face recall elections and all of that. It just doesn't seem to be in their best interest.
Well, I think Scott Walker has proven himself to be a lackey for the Heritage Foundation. I think the Heritage Foundation and the Tea Party, and there was one other type of that that came out immediately, you know, wholeheartedly supporting him. He has this agenda. That's why he would not compromise in any way on disbanding unions or deunionizing public employees. That's the real agenda.
All right, Jerry.
I think Naomi Klein, a writer for The Nation, has spelled it out really very clearly. She said that in the book Shock Doctrine.
Shock Doctrine. We're trying to get her again. We've had her on before, but I did see her the other night as well. She's very smart. She's really studied this issue all over the world. So we're trying to get her. Okay? Thank you very much for the call. And we go to Mary from Milwaukee. Hi, Mary.
Hey, Kathleen.
Hi, Mary.
First of all, let me say I'm devastated. My husband is a teacher's aide in working with cognitively disabled kids. You know, teachers' aides don't earn a heck of a lot of money, and our benefits are cut the same as everybody else's. And with the collective bargaining called into question, seniority goes out the window. That's devastating. Something that has bothered me all along in this is Walker constantly talking about the protesters versus taxpayers. Well, the protesters are all taxpayers, too. Mm-hmm. And he's not paying attention to the polls, and he just doesn't care.
Well, there is a cry, no matter where you are politically on this, there really is a cry for people to be able to talk to each other, for heaven's sake. There just is. People need to talk. They have different ideas that they need to sit down, and he needs to sit down probably with some of the people who are in Madison, people who are protesting. This is such a huge event.
Yeah, it is. And the kids are going to be the worst off for it all, and especially special needs kids.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mary, for
Thank
your call.
Thank you, Kathleen, always.
Yeah, thanks, Mary. Darren is next from La Crosse. Hi, Darren.
Hey, how are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
The current situation in Wisconsin is another extension of why we need a reform in our political campaign contributions system as it currently is. When you have this much money that becomes that important to these politicians, that they will ignore public sentiment,
mm-hmm.
Because clearly Scott Walker has aspirations beyond Wisconsin. That's evident. He has those overtures with the Tea Party, obviously his connections to the Koch brothers and Prosperity for America puts him on the fast track to national politics, and he needs to kowtow to those political interests, and you know the money is very important, and even here in La Crosse we have Dan Kopanky, who would like to be a congressman, and he cannot be seen as going against this governor because he needs the money to run against Ron Kind and to prevail. He needs to stick close to that money source. This is the problem. We need to continue to address how big money and money in general is become so important to our politicians that they ignore the will of the people to advance their own political agenda.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And it's not just the Republicans. The Democrats do this too with the health care bill. I remember when we had the whistleblower who used to be in the insurance business for so long, and I hadn't thought of this before. He said, don't worry about the Republicans being too wholeheartedly opposed to health care reform, because the lobbyists are going to show up in mass for all the new members, and everybody will kind of change his or her mind as a result of this. And plus, he said, you know, essentially, that industry wrote the health care bill that we have right now. And you think, well, come on, what's wrong with us? We've talked about this for years and years and years and years, and look what we get. I think you're right. Money talks, and it just shouldn't. It just shouldn't.
It continues to divide us along those political lines. I would also say that, you know, Governor Walker, he needed a bill in front of him. He could not advance, you know, the other portions of, his agenda without the passage of this particular bill. And, of course, the legalities of this will be challenged. But he did learn something from Governor Plenty in Minnesota when he tried to pass his particular budget bill circumventing, Minnesota law. So Governor Walker realized that he needed a bill, and he needed to get it very quickly because the political pressure that was being placed upon these senators through recall, but also I would say what was taking place in Ohio with Governor Kush, or I'm sorry,
Kasich.
Governor Kasich.
Mm-hmm.
He completed the mission, and the limelight for the Tea Party was going to quickly turn to him and put him a little bit more in favor with the Tea Party. It would take Governor Walker off the front pages. And so he needed this to be done quickly to maintain the news cycle. And it again, is just one of those things where if he can continue to be seen in the eyes of the Tea Party, Prosperity for America, the Heritage Foundation, as a person that's willing to do anything to advance that ideology, then he's going to maintain the stream of money coming his way for that 2012 election.
Thank you.
Election.
Thanks, Darren, for your call. We go to Jen next in Nebraska. Hi, Jen.
Hi, Kathleen. I lived in Wisconsin for about 10 years, and I miss it, but I've been back in Nebraska here for about seven. Now, Nebraska and many other states, well, this clearly is a way to just defund the opposition party. But here in Nebraska, most of the state is red, and most of the state you have to be Republican at the local level or you're going to have no decision-making powers. So I know many progressives and many liberals that just register as Republicans in order to have any sort of say at their local level, and maybe that's something that progressives should consider doing in Wisconsin.
All right, Jen, thank you. And what do you think about all that's happening here as you look at it from slightly afar?
To say the least.
Thanks very much for your call. Dennis is next in Richland Center. Hi, Dennis. Ooh, we got a bad line here. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
I've been disappointed in the Catholic Church's failure to weigh in on this because the teachings of the church are so clear. And I wonder if I could just read three sentences from the Pope's 2009 encyclical.
Well, I thought the churches had weighed in on this.
Some churches have. The Catholic Church hasn't. And the teaching is so clear.
The Archbishop in Milwaukee's weighed in on this.
Yeah, and then he said he was neutral on the issue, so he kind of backed away.
Hmm.
Could I read the encyclical, just three sentences?
I guess.
Okay. Governments, for reason of economic utility, often limit the freedom or the negotiating capacity of labor unions. Hence, traditional networks of solidarity have more and more obstacles to overcome. The repeated calls issued within the church's social doctrine for the promotion of workers' associations that can defend their rights must therefore be honored today more than in the past. And I think it's so clear and so powerful, and I hope that every Catholic will take note of that and get behind the unions and get behind the teachers and press for our ability to negotiate collectively.
Thank you, Janice, very much for your call. Well, I don't know where Joyce Carol Oates is, but evidently she will be calling us sometime soon. So the publicist reached her, and the deal is maybe in 7 minutes. Written like a true radio person, Chrissy. 7 minutes she will be joining us. We'll hold her to that. So until then, we'll just keep taking your phone calls. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Larry.
We go to Randy in Pewaukee next. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Kathleen. First-time caller. I've been listening to you for years, and I'm off today. I've got so much to say in a short time. You know, it was just such a sad day last night for the state of Wisconsin. This was broadcast throughout the whole country. And to see what I saw last night, it's just shameful what Scott Walker has done to our state in such a short period of time. Now, I'm a water operator. I'm not on the tax roll. My utility pays my salary through cellular phones, communications, and water consumption. My utility pays the city that I work for money in taxes that pays for the fire department, the police department, the public works department, the park department, the library department. And he's after all of us operators. And we couldn't understand why. Well, now we do. I belong to a local AFSCME union. Mr. Walker's decided to wage war on unions. Now, I've been up to Madison every weekend protesting. I'm 54 years old. I've been working for my community for 31 years. And I've never been called a union thug, a lefty, a democratic radical, but that's what I've been called, just because I'm protesting to keep my way of life for my family, and I don't want to see my children have to work harder than I had at work. Mm-hmm. I think Governor Walker is a product of AM talk radio here in Milwaukee. You know, I I stopped listening to AM radio years ago because I just, these people are just totally out of the loop. They don't understand what really is going on here. And the people that were protesting against us up in Madison are saying the same things that I hear the people on AM radio are saying. You know, this all this radical stuff. The gentleman that says, you know, $150 or $150,000 for a bus driver, look, I don't make half that. I don't even make a third of that.
Right.
I do get a pension. I do have health care, but I have to pay 11% for that, plus all these co-pays. You know, we've given and given and given all the years just to keep our pensions and a halfway decent insurance for my family. I can't work for nothing. I can't work for nothing. And that's basically what they're trying to do. They're trying to bust our unions. And also, I want to point out, I was an alderman. I know I've been on the other side of the table about collective bargaining. Collective bargaining works. It's just a tool that both parties uses to talk and to communicate and to get ideas about what each other can do. It's give and take. If you think collective bargaining is great for the unions, I got a message for you. You're wrong. It's hard to negotiate with cities.
Yeah. So what are you going to do now?
Well, I bought a bumper sticker that says Recall Walker. Going back up to Madison to protest. We're not organized like everybody thinks we are. We just show up. Like Michael Moore said last night, all of a sudden, you know, I went into a sandwich shop and got a sandwich, and 30 minutes after that, there's 20,000 people there. They're just, I don't know. I don't know what we're going to do. We're just going to fight. We're just going to keep fighting. And more, Kathleen, I saw people that weren't even union people there. They weren't college students. They were just regular folks coming out of their jobs, wherever, and picking up a sign and starting to march with us. So this doesn't have anything to do with unions. This doesn't have anything to do with collective bargaining. This is a shift in the whole structure of Wisconsin, and people are realizing, union, non-union workers, what this really is.
Thank you very much, Randy, for your call. Glad
you
called. Now you can call for the second time.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, when I'm off, I can't talk at work.
Okay. I understand.
Okay.
All right. Bye now. Thanks very much for the call. People need a place where they can talk. And I think what he says about the media, we should do a show on this at some point, is very true. I worked for an AM radio station for 18 years in this city, and we functioned under a fairness doctrine. And we had, when we had elections, we had people from all of the parties. We had all of the candidates. I remember when Russ Feingold was first running for office and we interviewed all of those people, and it was a whole different world. And I think there is something to be said for powerful media outlets only presenting one side of an issue and having an agenda and pushing it and pushing it and pushing it, because you know, a lot of people don't have time to do all the reading, to read tons of newspapers and to talk to a lot of people, nor perhaps a desire to have people sit and talk to each other who have different opinions. And the rhetoric is really kind of nasty and not very kind. And as Randy was saying, when people get together, it's hard. Give and take is a hard thing to do, but isn't that a pretty worthwhile thing to do? Isn't that worthwhile? Don't we want to decide together what kind of state we want to live in, and how our children should be educated, and how much money we should pay for the parks, and just sort of basic living questions that we need to talk about, and maybe we'll have really different ideas, but I understand what he's saying. And it's kind of a shame, and I love public radio, but it is a shame that you just don't find the kind of conversations that you have here, because when there are elections, we interview everybody, and these phone lines are open to people who have all kinds of different perspectives, and that's the way it should be. I'm sorry, I got rolling here. It's just quite a day, isn't it? And where is Joyce Carol Oates? You know, come on. All right. Thank you, Randy, very much for the call. Let's go next to Jeff in Milwaukee. Hi, Jeff.
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure, Jeff.
I'm bummed overall. There's no clear winner here. And hopefully that's the mark of a good compromise, although that doesn't sound right either. I mean, both sides are going to come away damaged, and there's going to be lots of healing that I think needs to happen. But I see some irony here in that how quickly we're forgetting that for every big money backer of our newly elected governor and representatives, if we look back 3 or 4 years, we see equally big money backers of what were then Democratic governors and representatives and so forth. So to me, we're kind of calling the kettle black here, except things have been reversed. I mean, this is the way it's been for quite a while, except now we have a different party, and we have to deal with one party not liking the change.
So what do you think we can do to get along with each other now? What needs to happen? Because living in this kind of atmosphere isn't very healthy for anybody.
Well, the part that irritates me probably the most is the 14 senators that walked out. And if we step back and look at the prior budget issues that were pushed off into the future, which in my opinion mostly created our current problem, is unresolved problems in the past 8 years, the Republicans were the minority party, and the Republicans sat and took their lumps and took their defeats, but they remained enmeshed and engaged in the process. Now we've got the roles reversed, equally inflammatory issues, equally punishing and damaging issues, but now there's no debate because 14 people have left. I think that's kind of the coward's way out. And they're sore losers, but I can't come down too hard because I'm a Democrat. So I'm just seeing the irony here. It's like they've done no evil in the past, when actually the unions have done as great an evil in the past as various other private backers are doing supposedly now with our current crop of so-called representatives. So there's no winners. I'm sorry this is happening. This is a great place, and I hope eventually someday we reemerge.
Yeah, I hope so too. It has been a great place. You're right. It's a great state. It has a great history, and it's pretty, and I like the parks. The lake is marvelous, and... Okay, thanks, Jeff. Thanks for the call. Goodbye. Larry in Kingston, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
First of all, I want to say my love and prayers go out to the Wisconsin 14, their modern-day heroes. You know, the Republican Party wants to give tax breaks to people that make over $250,000 a year but want to gouge our teachers and firemen and policemen. I really don't think Scott Walker is really an American. I mean, after all, he didn't play basketball or graduate from college. And his plan to privatize schools, I think, is against the will of the people. And it's going to hurt the Milwaukee school district so bad that I wouldn't be surprised if there's going to be riots.
All right, Larry, thank you very much for the call. I would hope there wouldn't be riots. You don't want that to happen. I've been impressed by how calm people have been, passionate, but just they're in huge numbers. And I would hope that that could continue. Jeff, I wanted to take a teacher here. And Gary from Shorewood. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Kathleen. I just had a call into you. I taught 32 years at the high school level in mathematics, and I was twice a presidential award winner for math and science in the state of Wisconsin. And in the last 7.5 years, I was involved in teacher training at one of our state universities for elementary school teachers. And I just want to know if people out there recognize what an effect this is going to have on potential teachers in the future.
Oh, I think you're right about that. People will think about whether or not they're going to go into teaching.
Well, being in mathematics, and we have a severe shortage of math teachers at the high school level. I ask friends quite often, if you had to do it over, would you go into teaching? And, you know, teaching prospective teachers at the university level, I can't tell you how many times I said, I love teaching. But at this point, if I had to do it, there's no way. that I would do that. You know, I'd go into engineering or some other area that involved mathematics, actuarial work. But this climate right now, it's going to have a tremendous effect on what's going on in the state and education. If I was at the high school level now, I would be looking to get out.
Well, maybe it will change.
It'll change for which direction?
That people will appreciate teachers more.
Well, you know, I talk with people about that situation, and in the, you know, the Asian countries, teachers are revered. You know, they're brought home from the students in their class, and they're just idolized. And here, teachers are looked at as demons, essentially. You know, everybody says, well, my kid's teacher is really good, but it's the rest of them that are no good.
Yeah. Well, we said facetiously last hour, maybe we ought to do this. Let's just outsource education. We'll all go to China from, what, kindergarten? No, pre-kindergarten, four-year-old kindergarten through 12th grade, and then come back. What a morning. What a week. What a month. Joyce Carol Oates, we found her. So she's going to be with us in a moment. Entirely different topic, but she spent time in Wisconsin. I'll ask her what she thinks about what's going on here at the top of our shorter interview. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joyce Carol Oates is with us now. Joyce Carol Oates, thank you so much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi. Hi. We missed you. I'm glad we found you.
Well, I'm happy to be here. There was just a confusion because I did have a telephone interview from the BBC this morning.
Ah.
Confusing.
Uh-huh. I know that you met your husband at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and you went to school there. And I'm just wondering, I'm sure that you know what's happening in Madison these days and probably what happened yesterday. Do you have any thoughts about what's going on in this state?
Well, basically, a conservative Republican and politicians were elected. So I think that is the explanation for what's going on. And if that were the case in any state in the United States, the same sort of thing would go on. When you have people in power who are not sympathetic with education or with teachers, they're sympathetic with big business, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So that's basically it. I don't think there's an ideology or dislike of teachers. I think it's basically just a political bias in favor of people with money and not wanting to raise taxes.
Mm-hmm. You met your husband, Raymond Smith, in Madison. You were both students. You were students in the English department in Madison. He was studying Jonathan Swift, right?
Well, he was studying the 18th century. He was writing a book on Jonathan Swift. Yes, we had a wonderful meeting. It was very romantic, and I have wonderful, wonderful associations with Madison, Wisconsin.
Uh-huh. I love the fact that, and you were, what, engaged about a month after you met in a literature class and then married shortly thereafter.
Yes, yes.
Are you real familiar with Milwaukee? I was interested to read that he had gone to Marquette High School and grew up in the city that I'm speaking to you from this morning.
Well, I knew Milwaukee a bit better because we would go back to visit Ray's family. And I've been back several times since. Wonderful art museum.
Yes, beautiful.
Just beautiful, beautiful. Yes, it's a lovely city with an emphasis on reading and literature. And Minneapolis is another very nice city.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in the fact that you can't remember a time in all of your years together, and there were many, when you called each other by your first names, it was always honey.
Yes, it's strange how these customs begin almost immediately, and then once they begin, they don't get changed. Like, I never called my parents anything except Mom and Dad, or
uh-huh.
Mommy or Daddy. I never called them by their first names. Just never did that.
Yeah.
I don't know at what point one starts to call a parent by the given name rather than Daddy or Mommy.
Right. I don't know what that is either. And why did he, when you look back at those years, because you're right about those as well, your whole time together, what caught your eye? What tickled your fancy about this man?
Well, Ray was, as everybody has said, a very gentlemanly man. He's very kind, very thoughtful. He had a quiet, droll sense of humor. In any group, he was likely to be one who would be listening.
Mm.
You know, other people tell stories, and they sort of dominate. Ray was a wonderful listener, and of course, with me, he was. I mean, we talked quite normally, but in a group, he would be likely to be a little quiet.
You spend time at the beginning of the book talking about an automobile accident that you had about a year before his pneumonia. And then I can see how it would just drive you insane to think about he has pneumonia. You go to the hospital. You think, well, they've diagnosed this. And then it just unravels after that. It's just you didn't know it was the last week you would ever have with him.
Well, that's true. Yes, that's absolutely true. I was having all the time with people. You know, since I wrote the memoir and since it's been a couple of years, I look around and think this is happening all the time. And in countries all around the world, people are losing complete families.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that this loss that's so overwhelming to me and to a widow is replicated hundreds of thousands of millions of times, you know, every day practically. And that's what's so terrifying, to think that we're put on earth, you know, and we have all these sympathetic connections with other people, and one by one they're all broken.
And did it make you, this whole experience in writing the book, even more aware of all of those tragedies and all of those losses? Or did writing this book, which death can do to all of us, death of a loved one, withdraw and become more isolated from the world? Or were both happening?
Well, if you read the book, you know that I continue to teach and to travel, and obviously I was not withdrawn at all. I mean, I'm a professor at Princeton University, and I continued to be teaching.
You traveled even more, didn't you, after Ray died?
Well, I traveled a lot. I canceled one or two trips, but then I just continued. I thought I might as well be miserable traveling as miserable at home. And I don't really like to cancel out. I feel an obligation. If I say I do something, then I should do it.
You talk about dying and the thought that, you know, you could have died together in that automobile accident. At one point in the book, you talk about not being able to imagine outliving your mother and your father because you were close to them and you couldn't imagine life without them. What about with Ray? Did you think that you would have preferred to have gone with him? Did it take every ounce of your strength to just carry on as a widow?
I'm not sure how to answer that, really. When an emergency happens, we just go into automatic pilot,
mm-hmm.
and we do things almost like a zombie. Like, I was always trying to figure out, what should I say now? And it was like I was in a movie. You know, I didn't have time for any emotions right away. The emotions come later, so you sort of do one thing, and then somebody says, well, now you have to go to the funeral home. Now you have to go to the probate court. And my wonderful woman friend, Jeannie Halpin, drove me to these places. So she said, I'll come to get you at 8 in the morning and bring the death certificate and bring your marriage certificate and bring this. She just told me what to do, and I did it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I were all alone and didn't have anyone to do that, I probably just have stayed in bed in the house or something. So it's a little hard to answer the question. But you go into automatic pilot, and I'm sure that happens when people are in disasters. You know, like Hurricane Katrina, there probably were people behaving like heroes and heroines who were doing amazing things. But later on, they would say, well, I just did it, you know, without thinking.
It was such a poignant scene when you were called, and this must have been a horrible moment, in the middle of the night, when you thought you had a fairly good day with your husband and thought you were going to see him the next day, and you got this call in the middle of the night saying that he was gone. And so you go back to the hospital, and I felt so sorry for you because there was nobody there who had cared for him, really. There was nobody there to be with you. You were utterly alone. You didn't know what to do. You didn't know if you should call a funeral home. they were curt with you when you asked that question. It was just such a sad scene, wasn't it?
Well, I guess it was sad. I was sort of like a zombie, and any little bit of kindness would have been so welcome.
Mm-hmm.
Like if a nurse had come up and said, I really loved Ray. It was wonderful, and I'll give you a suggestion for a funeral home. Anybody could just have said that. It would have been so meaningful. You know, even though you've lost your husband, a little bit of kindness just means so much. And there's quite a bit in the memoir about how good my friends were.
Mm-hmm.
And friends, just especially women friends, they just sort of come. And men, well, there were some men, too, who were very wonderful. I mean, we can't get along without our friends.
How true. We certainly can't. But you have to go in, and when you talk about automatic pilot, and all of a sudden you're entering this world where you just don't know very much about what you need to do, all the death certificates you're going to need and how the body will be disposed of, and all of this information, they have to enter a whole different world, as you do when you go into the hospital mode, too, don't you?
Yes, but I'm really terrified of going into a hospital now. Because so many people have told me the same thing happened to someone in their family.
Mm.
They went in for a relatively minor ailment or medical procedure and got a terrible infection and died, or in some cases were sick for weeks and weeks and weeks. And these infections are caused by doctors and other medical staff not washing their hands sufficiently. So as soon as you go into a hospital, you're just putting yourself at great risk.
Were you mad at all those people? Were you mad?
Oh, no. I was completely exhausted. And then I was depressed. You have to have a lot of energy to be angry.
Mm-hmm.
Anger is probably a very healthy emotion, but there are many of us in the world who can't rise to the level of anger. We're just too exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
For me, just getting through one day was enormously took terrible effort. I could only divide the day into about five parts. You know, what few hours and then this. I couldn't even think of a day but as an entity. It had to be divided into parts.
When you, I wonder if you thought about this a whole lot and how you answer this now. You asked the question, if I had known that we had less than a week together when he went into the hospital, if you would have done anything differently. Does that plague you now? Would you have? Have you answered that?
Oh, yes, certainly I would have been at the hospital all the time. As he got better, I brought work in for him to do, and then I was teaching. I would go off to the university and teach and come back to the hospital. Then I would come home and have a meal. I would be sitting at my computer working. You know, I spent a lot of time away from Ray, too. And when I was with him, we were both working. He was working in bed, and I was working in the chair because I was teaching. So, and then the last night, I would sit and stayed there. It's possible that if I'd been there, maybe he would still be alive. I mean, I really don't know. The problem was that all his doctors and the nurses who took care of him were gone. It was a very late Sunday night. You don't find doctors in a hospital. I mean, you know, the higher-ranking doctors. You know, they're not there. They come in Monday morning.
Mm.
The best time to have a medical crisis is Monday morning. There'll be doctors there. But like at midnight of a Sunday or Saturday, you can imagine who's on the staff.
So we'll all...
Say if you got really, really sick, terribly ill, and it's Christmas Eve. That's not the good time to go into the hospital. You can imagine. You know, that's sort of what happened with Ray. It was just that one time, maybe. And he didn't get the best treatment, I guess. He would probably have gotten much better treatment. I've gotten letters from doctors who said that they would have done the treatment differently. Now, I have no way of knowing whether they're correct because I don't have the qualification. But people read the piece in The New Yorker, and they wrote to me, and they said, no, 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 they would have done this, they would have done that, and your husband would still be alive, things like that. So it's, how do I know?
You almost don't want to hear that, do you? Because that can just haunt you.
I know. Well, I've gone through a lot of these thoughts, so they're a little bit like hornets buzzing around in a small space. They buzz and they rush past my head, and they're buzzing around my head, and I can't deal with them, so I just let them go. I just let them buzz. I can't deal with it.
Yeah. I thought that the passages about the garden were so beautiful that he loved the garden, and I'm wondering if you've kept it going.
Well, yes, I moved to another house, and I brought a lot of raised plants over here, so the same plants are here. And some of the house plants are here also. Yeah, that's a little later in the memoir. I was getting better then. The first few weeks were really difficult, and I never really thought that I would live much longer. I was always so surprised when I sort of wake up in the morning. I just would thought that I wouldn't wake up anymore.
Why? Why did you think you wouldn't wake up?
Have you ever been close to a person who died?
I almost died myself, yeah.
That's, oh.
Yeah, I know what it's like. I was.
Well, it seemed much easier to die than to live.
Yes.
It seemed that the easiest thing in the world would just be that you stopped breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Or your heart stopped. And the fact that I was still alive was so surprising to me. And then people would ask what my plans were, and I thought they were being completely unreasonable because I didn't think I'd be around. I really didn't think so. And planning even for next year, a couple of years from now, I never do it anymore because I don't really have faith in my own future, I guess.
So the book came, I read about your process of writing this, that you were keeping notes, that there were, you know, a whole thing near your bedstand of notes that you had written. Did a book pour forth from you, or did you think right after Ray died, I'm going to have to do something with this, and I am a writer, and I want to reach to people who've experienced it? How do we get a book from this? And it's a beautiful book.
Oh, well, no, I didn't think about that for a long time, really. In the summer of 2009, when I was trying to write a novel about a woman whose husband had died, I couldn't really do it because I was so haunted by my own experience. So I thought I would go to my journal and that I would take out of the journal passages and impressions and memories and work it into a kind of mosaic. I mean, I could have begun anywhere. I could have begun with taking Ray to the hospital. So I had to choose which chapter I would begin with. I mean, I did some things that are compositional. But basically, I had already written most of the entries in longhand late at night when I couldn't sleep. And so I took all these passages, and lots of which I scraps of paper and things, and arranged it. And then I worked on it as a composition. But originally, it wasn't a composition. It was just like diary entries. You know, like I would say, I was in hospital today, and I did this and this, and I was teaching, and this and this and that. And a little bit of what Ray said at the hospital, or what the doctor said. So it was like a diary and a journal. And then I took those notes and made them into something more writerly. And then when I was all done with it, I wrote several chapters that are written. They're written chapters about the living in Detroit in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
when we first got married, and Ray's background. So I did both writing and assembling. It wasn't that I sat down and read a memoir. And I don't trust a memoir that's a summary, that somebody says, when I was 10 years old, I had a happy childhood, or all through my life I was unhappy. You know, those big blanket statements, I don't trust them too much because I remember my own experience was very, very variegated.
Mm-hmm.
Once this emotion, this, that. One day you want to die, the next day you feel better, and your friends help you, and then this. And so it was completely like a roller coaster ride. And that's why I think that a conventional memoir that reaches back into the past and summarizes, it's just not that real to me. It's
mm-hmm.
not, doesn't have the reality and immediacy. Because when you're living your life, it's very breathless. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow.
No.
You don't know what's going to happen even later on today if you're in a hospital vigil. And so any kind of memoir that has a summary, it falsifies that immediate feeling.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Joyce Carol Oates, for being with us. And thanks for the book. It is, it's a beautiful book. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Goodbye. Joyce Carol Oates, our guest for at least part of this hour. Her latest book is A Widow's Story, a memoir, which has just been published. And the interview was short, so we didn't get into a lot about their time in Madison and her husband growing up in Milwaukee, but all of that is very interesting. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. I feel like I need to take a deep breath. What a morning. It's just been kind of wild, has it? Thanks for your calls, everybody. I'll be with you again on Monday, where we'll have all things political at 9 o'clock. And, you know, who knows? Who knows what we'll talk about? But there's something happening next. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network.